Okay, we are here today at United Orthodox Synagogues on May 4th in Houston, Texas. We are back again after a little bit of a break for our weekly lunch and learn on Parshat HaShavua. And this week we're going to read Parshat Acharei Mot. So we are going to begin on page 244 in our Tanakh. Okay, so we open up with an interesting, with a prohibition that is given to from God to Moshe, and that Moshe is then supposed to relate this prohibition to his brother Aaron. So let's start from the beginning, page 244, chapter 16, verse 1. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe, acharei mot shnei bnei Aaron, v'karvatam lefnei Hashem v'yamutu. So God spoke to Moses after the death of Aaron's two sons. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. And then God said to Moshe, Daber el Aharon achicha, va'al yavo b'chol eit el hakodesh, mibet laparoch el pnei kaporet. Tell your brother Aaron that he is not to come at will into the shrine, which is into the kodesh hakodashim, of the Mishkan, behind the curtain, in front of the cover that is upon the ark, v'lo yamut, lest he die, ki be'anan e'ra'e al hakaporet. For I appear in the cloud over the cover. He's not allowed to go there anytime he wants. When can he go? B'zot yavo aron el hakodesh, b'parben bakar l'chatat v'ayel le'ola. Thus only shall Aaron enter the shrine with a bull of the herd for a sin offering and a ram for the burnt offering. He shall be dressed in the sacral linen tunic with linen breeches next to his flesh and be girt with linen sash, etc. This is talking about Yom Kippur. He's only allowed to go into this place on Yom Kippur.
What's the difference between a sin offering and a burnt offering?
There are different types of karbanot. A sin offering is burnt specifically for a sin. Other types of offerings can be brought for holidays, can be brought voluntarily. So the different types. Sin offering is specifically brought when someone has sinned. Okay.
But how do you know when you've sinned?
You know.
No, I mean, you don't.
Sure, you. Why not?
Sometimes you don't.
Sometimes you don't. Right. I mean, but when, obviously, you can't bring
it. Like I'm sitting here eating this great tuna fish. And it could be a sin. I mean, I'm just using it.
Right. So obviously, you can't bring a karban for a sin you don't know about. But if you do know that you sinned, then you bring it. If you don't, right. And then there are different types of sins, right? You could bring. You're actually the example you gave was a good one, because if you sin on purpose, then you know it, and then you bring a karban for it. But let's say you sin by accident. Let's say I send an email later and say, "Oops, the tuna fish wasn't kosher. It was actually shark fish. I hope you enjoyed it, but it wasn't kosher." So that would be what you call shogeg. That would be an inadvertent sin. That's a different type of karban. So yeah, you're right. Sometimes you know, and sometimes you don't, and sometimes you only find out later.
But who's the sinner? The guy who made the shark, or the guy who ate it?
The guy who ate it. The guy who ate it. The guy who ate it.
So you sinned, but you really didn't.
They're both right. So he said you could sin without knowing. It's called shogeg, and it happens a lot. Hopefully there are more of those than mazid. Hopefully there are more accidental sins than purpose.
Yeah, but when Aaron does the sin offering, does he do it for the congregation? Because he's
On Yom Kippur, it's both. It's for him and the congregation. Right? It's for... Okay. So, this halacha of not going into the Holy of Holies, the Sanctum Sanctorum, other than once a year, is codified by the Rambam and others as well, but we'll just read how the Rambam codifies it on page 1 of the handout. Okay. It says as follows. We are in the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot. The Rambam, besides writing a code of law and a very important philosophical work and lots of letters, also wrote a Sefer HaMitzvot, where he enumerated the 613 commandments, the positive commandments and the negative commandments, And he gives a brief explanation of each of the mitzvot. And this is the exhortation against the high priest entering the holy places at all times, because of the honor of the holy place and fear before the Shekhinah. As the Exalted One said, now he quotes our Pasuk, and let him not come at all times to the holy place, right? Va'al yavo b'chol eit el HaKodesh, meaning at any time, you can't come in, only specific times. There are lines of demarcation to this negative commandment. So how does that work? What are the specifics? The high priest is exhorted against entering the Holy of Holies even on Yom Kippur, except at the time specified for the service. So not only is he only allowed in there on Yom Kippur, he's only allowed in there at a certain time on Yom Kippur. Similarly, every Kohen is exhorted against entering the sanctuary all the days of the year, except the time of the service. The negative commandment then, in short, is as follows. No Kohen may enter the place where he is permitted to enter except at the time of the service. Both the high priest within the Holy of Holies and the other priests outside the Holy of Holies in the sanctuary. Right? There were two parts of the sanctuary. There was the Holy and the Holy of Holies. The only person allowed in the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, was the Kohen Gadol. And he's only allowed in at a specific time of the year, on Yom Kippur, at a specific time. And the other Kohanim are the only ones allowed in the other part of the sanctuary, but they are also only allowed to go in during the regular service, the Avodah. They can't just sort of take their, it's not like getting a tour of the West Wing, right? You can't just take your friend for a tour of that part of the Beit HaMikdash. Right. Yeah.
It says here, it quotes the what we're reading about Leviticus.
Yeah.
But is it, I'm sure it's somewhere before this, correct, that they knew, that Aaron's sons knew? Was it in the Torah somewhere before this?
No, this so is it.
They did something they didn't know they were doing wrong.
Well, they didn't necessarily die for this. This is not necessarily what they died for. No, that's a good question. They didn't necessarily die for this. This is telling you when the mention of Aaron's sons dying is telling us when this law was given.
It says when they drew too close.
Right, but it's unclear. We studied that. It's unclear. Right. It could be this, in which case, yes, we'd have to assume that this was given earlier. But others say it's not this. It was because they were drunk other things. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you have a question, Danielle?
I do.
Oh, okay.
People were never allowed into the temple.
In certain places. But this is in certain places, yes, but in certain places, no. There were other courtyards, okay. If he transgressed this negative commandment and entered outside the time of service, if he entered the Holy of Holies, he's liable to death, and if the sanctuary, he is liable to stripes, lashes. Right, that's what stripes mean. In the words of Sifra, and let him not come at all times, Yom Kippur, to the holy place, to include the other days of the year within the curtain, to exhort against entering the entire sanctuary. I might think that entering the entire sanctuary entails the death penalty. It is therefore written within the ark cover, which is on the ark, that he not die. How is this to be understood? Within the ark cover, death. The rest of the sanctuary, transgression of an exhortation. And in Menachot, they say that explicitly for entering the sanctuary, 40 stripes. So here at the end, the Rambam is telling us that there are different sins. If you enter into the Kodesh HaKadoshim improperly, it's a death penalty. And if you enter into the Kodesh, the one step down in terms of holiness, it's prohibited. But it doesn't come with a death penalty. It comes with stripes, lashes. Okay? So that's the halacha that's taught at the beginning of this week's Parsha, and how it is understood by the Rambam and others as well. So let's begin with this question. Why? Right? Why is it that Aaron, or any other Kohen Gadol for that matter, is not allowed to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim but one day a year at a specific time? And why is it that the other Kohanim are only allowed into the Kodesh, the other part of the Beit HaMikdash, also, only during the time of the day when the sacrifice is being brought? Meaning, why can't you take them you take your parents on a tour, or your visiting cousins or your friends on a tour of the Kodesh HaKadoshim? It's
God's presence is there, and that's his private area. You're only there for one reason. The reason to go there is to be up here for the
Yeah, that's true. It is God's private. That's what he said. But first of all, does God really need,
he need
a private area?
It's crowded out.
Right. It's not like he's right. And you're right. But okay.
I think then it becomes mundane, and if you have certain rules, it becomes a little bit more important.
Okay. Good. It becomes good.
Come in there. They may have just be discussing things that maybe aren't appropriate. You know,
okay.
Where are we going to go for dinner tonight after we...
So, people who are not properly trained,
right,
maybe, a right frame of mind,
mindset.
Right? By the way, we have similar laws of shuls, right? You're not supposed to engage in mundane conversation in the sanctuary of a shul, right? Like you said, where are you going for dinner tonight? You should not have that conversation in the sanctuary of the shul. You should not talk about anything, actually, other than religious matters in the sanctuary of a shul.
But is that only when services are going on?
No.
Or just all the time?
Always. All the time. All the time.
So if there's no services in the shul, you should not discuss anything outside of just religious stuff.
That's the... Correct. Now, our shuls, there may be some technical reasons why we're exempt from that rule. Maybe our shuls are built with a specific condition in mind that they're not going to have that level of sanctity. But in best case scenario, yeah, we're not supposed to engage in those conversations. No, not just Shabbos. Anytime. That's a separate issue. Not talking about business on Shabbos is a separate issue. We're talking about going into the sanctuary, like on today, on a Wednesday afternoon, and sitting there and having a conversation with your buddy about business. That conversation, even though you're not interrupting davening, right, should not happen in the sanctuary.
Much more open than it was. According to the way I read it here, these were enclosed. The Holy of Holies was enclosed. The Holy wasn't closed. It wasn't open to the public. That's the way I see it.
Right, but I'm saying even though our shuls are open to the public, we still have strict rules
but
about...
not as strict as they were.
Correct.
Are those prohibitions now a result of this passage?
It's an extension, exactly. It's an extension of this passage. The sort of awe that this passage is telling us about is extended to our sanctuaries, which have lots of things that are compared in terms of how we're supposed to act vis-a-vis how we were supposed to act during the time of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and later when the permanent temples were built.
When the shuls were really first built, were they open like they are now, or was there more?
Yeah, yeah.
This is an open shul. It's just a...
No. I mean open that there wasn't like... where you read the Torah
was more enclosed, or you go to ancient shuls in Israel. They're just like ours. They're just smaller, and the walls fell down, but they had walls and. They just didn't have classrooms or a copy room.
No, it just sounds like the Holy of the Holiest and the holes were not open to the public.
Correct, but we're talking about shuls are different. Shuls were always open to the public. Okay, so all the answers given were excellent.
Part of it is also they didn't want people getting in the way. I mean, you know, for example, when they were doing the Korban Pesach, you know, if you had mentioned a few weeks ago maybe about how they did the sacrifices, I mean, the amount of people that were in there.
Right.
And you had the industrial line of the Kohanim where they're doing the service. If anyone kind of got in the way, threw off the whole machine.
Okay, that's a good point. There was in the Beit HaMikdash, on certain days it was especially busy, but even every day there were certain things that had to happen.
All the Kohanim had their specific service jobs,
right?
Because if you just let everyone in there, it's going to be a mess.
Right. Okay. Great. It could be.
It's
true.
And in the other case, then now it's a passive davening. We're not physically doing anything.
Well, we should be davening.
No. We're not killing an
either
animal.
Most people in my experience are either davening or talking.
No.
Or
like,
sleeping.
But we're not killing an animal. But we're not killing an animal.
Right.
We're not lighting candles.
Right. Okay, so let's see. The Ralbag here offers a fascinating explanation as to why this prohibition exists, and then an amazing admission, which you rarely see, as to one of the great challenges of regular ritual. Okay, it's really, when I read this, I found it to be very interesting in terms of how open he is. So we're on page 3, And we're the first big paragraph here. I'm sorry I didn't mark it off, where it says HaToelet HaRishon. Everyone with me? Okay, so the Ralbag, he has a multi-level commentary. One of the things that he does is he offers some practical applications of the various mitzvot in the Torah and the various narratives of the Torah. Just a quick some quick notes on the Ralbag. He was born in 1288 in Banneau-sur-Cèze in France, and he died also in France in 1344. Levi ben Gershon, Gersonides, or the Ralbag, philosopher, mathematician, physician, Talmudist, astronomer, astrologer, and he has a fascinating approach to Torah commentary. So here we go. HaToelet HaRishon Hu B'mitzvot. The first purpose or practical purpose we learn from this parsha has to do with mitzvot. V'hu ha'azhara milavo lifnei v'lifnim shelo letzorech avodah. This is the prohibition or the warning against coming inside to the inside, meaning that's the Kodesh HaKadashim, unless it is the time of the Yom Kippur service. V'toelet zo ta'azhara mevuar. And the reason for this is explained. Kima sheyurgal ha'adam b'ri'iyato, something that someone is accustomed to see or to encounter, lo yaflig lachkor al inyano. Will the more something is familiar, the less effort someone will put into trying to understand it. Right? This is really so insightful. Right? The more you encounter something, the less effort you will put into trying to understand it. V'latet alibo lema haya baze haofen. And to try to understand why it's done in this way. L'choshvo shekvar efshar lo l'roto tamid. After all, you think, I could always see it. K'mo sheyaflig b'mesh shelo yireh oto ki'im li'itim rechokim. As opposed to that which you will put effort into trying to, that we always see once. I'll give you an example. You've all been in the shul by this time hundreds of times. Probably no one in this room knows when this room was built, when that room was built, who the president was, what the history is. Then you go to Europe, and you go visit a synagogue in Europe once, and you read in the front when it was built, who paid for it, what happened during this war, what happened during that war. And the time you come home, you know more about a synagogue that you spent an hour in and you'll likely never see again than you know about your own synagogue. True? Fair? I think that's a fair picture.
So why don't we have a plaque like that?
That's a good question. We should. But no one, you know, goes, when you get to Europe, you go online. You Google, I'm going to see the great synagogue in Florence. So I want to know everything about it before I go. Who's ever Googled
UOS
to find out how many, which of the three synagogues it was made up of, when the merge happened.
But is that online?
Yeah, of course it's online. It's on our website.
On your website.
There you go. No, it's on our website. Our history is on the website. And there I go. My point has been proven. Okay? So something that you rarely encounter, you want to know, but something you always encounter, you don't put as much effort into it. That's what the Ralbag says. Okay. This explains what the Torah was getting at here. Im shama shelo shema shelo yutar ladam l'roto b'choletzi. It said the fact that the Torah doesn't allow you into these parts of the tabernacle whenever you want. Kim pamachat b'shana, once a year, and only one person. Then it becomes a curiosity. Wow, you're not allowed in there. Only one person's allowed in there. What's going on in there? Why do they do it? I want to find out about this. That will cause a person to think about it and to research what's going on. And that's exactly what the Torah wants. The Torah wants you to understand what's going on in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Torah wants you to understand what's going on in Yom Kippur and in the temple. So if they let you, so the Torah says, if we gave you access, you would never try to understand. But if we limit access, and he's saying the more access is limited, right, the more mysterious it is, the better chance someone's going to think about it.
We got Torah. He's saying this. The Torah says
it. No, the Torah limits it, and he's explaining why. Right. V'kivayit b'er l'cha miyut anah. Now, okay, that's his explanation. Now he makes this amazing admission about davening. Okay, we all daven, but how much of how many people really? Right, we come in, we open the sitter, we say it, we close the sitter till next time. We come back, we open it, we say it. How many of us spend time when we're not that, right? The time to learn about davening is not when you're davening. That's the time to daven. The time to learn about davening is when you're not davening, right? So listen to what he says. This is really amazing. You don't get these types of admissions very often. He says, "V'kvayit ber lecha miu tavanat adam b'davar hamurgal." And I could explain to you why there is limited understanding of things that people are accustomed to. Sha'ata tir'e be'elu hatfilot hanifla'ot asher sidru lanu an shekines hagadola. We have these amazing prayers that the men of the great assembly established for us, like the Amidah. Shelerov hur galenu bahem, because we are so familiar with them, nidaber behem tamid, we always say them and talk about them. V'lo nishtadel la'amod al sodam. But we don't try to understand their deeper meaning. Ad sheyeze siba l'rabim mechachamenu. Listen to this. And that's why so many of our sages sheyit'u harbeit b'dabramahem make mistakes when they talk about the davening, because they haven't spent time, right? Limiut amidatam al hamichuvan bahem, because the limited amount of time they spend trying to understand them, right? So that's really an amazing thing he's saying. We daven all the time, but we're so used to it, we're so accustomed to it, we don't spend any time really trying to understand it. And then he goes further. V'chein timtza mitoratenu hashlema. The same is true with Torah. Shelerov hergalenu ba. The fact that we are so accustomed to the Torah, we come every Shabbos and we hear the Torah reading being read. Ba nistapaknu b'kriyat talavad. So therefore, we are satisfied with just hearing the reading or reading it. V'lo namik lamod al kavanata. We don't spend time really trying to understand the depths of it. Ad she'ein l'rabim mibikiei chachamenu shum tziur baharbe me'minya. And there's no one, even those who know the Torah well, who really know it deeply. Kimo melechet ha'mishkan v'keilav v'nei ha'kabarno. Like all the things we're talking about now, the building of the Mishkan, the various items used in the Mishkan, the karbanot, v'atumot v'atarot, purity and impurity, u'ma she'yidme lahem, and similar things. U'michlal ze ha'azhara gam kein. That's why we have the warning not to go there except during the time of the service. That's why we have this reason. Okay, we don't have to get to the rest. So really, I find this so refreshing and fascinating, right? He's taking his own class of people to task, right? The rabbis and learned people who spend so much time davening and so much time reading the Torah are satisfied with sort of a surface or a shallow understanding of it. Why? Because we're so familiar of it. But if it becomes a secret, things that are a secret, that's really what I want to understand. That's really what I want to know. So that's a very nice interpretation. But it does beg the question about davening, which is how we're supposed to fix the problem, right? Right. So one answer is stop davening. Right? If we didn't daven three times a day and we only davened once a year, then maybe, right, it's like Yom Kippur comes once a year and all of a sudden the shuls are full. Right? So maybe if we only davened once in a while, then we would then we would pay more attention to it. We would understand it. We would, because we would want to, because it has a sort of sense of mystery, we would want to understand. Now, that's obviously not the answer the rabbis came up with, because even though there is this danger, the rabbis presumably felt it was a greater danger not to daven at all, right? So on the one hand, we have a danger of davening becoming something rote and something we're used to and something we rush through and something we don't pay attention to. But the rabbis weren't willing to say, well, the solution then is to, well, let's just not daven that much.
It says the rabbis are always right.
Fair point. Fair point.
No, I see people, and I do the same thing during services. I see people reading books, religious books, rather than
right.
davening. I do the same thing sometimes with a Chumash or something.
Right.
You're not davening, but you're learning. So what's better?
Right. So there, it's not what's better. There's a time for davening. There's a time for learning. So the first answer is right, is do what we're doing, right? This is, we don't give a Parshat HaShavua class when we're reading the Torah. Hopefully we learn the Parsha in depth, or at least part of the Parsha in depth, like we do every week, before we get to Torah reading. That's why we do the Parsha of the week before Shabbat, so that when we read it, we have a deeper understanding of it. That's it's not a question of what's more important. It's a question of timing. It's
but
a question of...
An hour and a half a day of repetition compared to an hour and a half a day of learning.
Right. So there should be both.
Yeah.
Right. There should be both. And it's true. It's true. Davening, I would say, if you daven three times a day, takes approximately 45 minutes to an hour. Right. Shacharit is 30, 35 minutes. Mincha is 10 minutes, 12 minutes. Maariv is 10 minutes. So you're between 45 minutes and an hour. That's true. And hopefully we could eke out some time also during the day to study. Now, there's another an interesting approach, which is another problem which is related to this, not directly, and that is, as we said, when something is common and done often, we tend to ignore it, right? Because it doesn't have mystery. We feel, since we have access to it, right, we don't really study it. It's like, you know, a dollar bill. Right? How many of us have really looked at a dollar bill and understood the symbolism and why this picture's on the dollar bill and why that picture's on the dollar bill? When you get the, you know, what's the biggest denominational bill we have? $10,000 bill, right? I guess then whatever it is, that we probably pay more attention to that because we rarely see it. It's like a $2 bill, even though it's not worth a lot of money. It's so rare. It's become something we look at a little bit more. There's a similar problem when it comes to davening, right? We daven three times a day, and we rush through it because we're very... Now, the rabbis were not unfamiliar or insensitive to this challenge, right? There's a very interesting debate in Masechet Brachot, in the Talmud, that deals with the question of where do we get the notion of davening three times a day from? Right, that's a debate. One rabbi says we learn the commandment to daven three times a day from the karbanot in the Beit HaMikdash. Right, there was a morning karban, an afternoon karban, and an evening karban, and so therefore we daven shacharit, mincha, and maariv, and that speaks to sort of a very fixed, right? Because as Daniel rightly pointed out, the karbanot were very highly choreographed, every step was taken into account, every aspect of the ritual in the Beit HaMikdash was very specific. You were not supposed to, waver to the right or to the left at all. You're supposed to just stay on track. So that approach would then indicate that davening also is very, very set, which it is on some level, right? We have the Amidah, which is the same Amidah, three times a day, every day. On Shabbat, we have some variation, but the first three brachot and the last three brachot are the same. On Yom Tov, we have some variation, but the first three brachot and the last three brachot are always the same. So there's not a tremendous amount of variation. And even if there is, even so, on Shabbat, every Shabbat is the same. And every Yom Tov, every Pesach is the same, and every Sukkot is the same. So there's not a tremendous amount of variation. On the other hand, there's another view that says the model for us davening three times a day are the Avot, are Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That Avraham davened, the Torah indicates that he davened in the morning, and Yitzchak davened in the afternoon, and Yaakov davened at night. And just as they each davened at their specific time, we are supposed to mimic them, and we are also supposed to daven at those specific times. Now that may point to a much more open type of tefillah, right? Because they didn't daven a set prayer. They said what was on their mind, right? They had a specific problem they were dealing with, and they just said what was on their mind, right? So you have these dueling notions in the Talmud as to what is the template for tefillah. Is it the set, established, highly choreographed, specific with specific rules like it was in the Beit HaMikdash? Or is the template the model of the Avot, which is much more freestyle, right? Like a freestyle davening as opposed to a, much more personal. So the answer is it's both, right? It's not that we have to try our best to find a way to incorporate both approaches. So on the one hand, we have a very, very set, specific text of tefillah, right? You open up the Amidah, every sitter is the same. Ashkenazi, Sephardi, you know, limited variation, okay? However, a lot of people are not aware of this following a text of the, a lot of people are not aware that the Shulchan Aruch says as follows, okay? Im ratza lehosif b'chol bracha meha'emtza'it me'ein ha'bracha mosif. Right, this is very interesting. We have a set davening. Let's say you're up to the bracha of, let's just take a popular one, Rifa'enu. Right, the bracha in the Amidah where we ask for someone for health. It's the same thing. You know, it almost rolls off. Rifa'enu, it just rolls off your tongue, right, very quickly. Right? So what does the Shulchan Aruch say? How are we supposed to now make the same brachot that we say hundreds of times a year meaningful to us if I'm just rattling them off? So the Shulchan Aruch says, if you want to add something in any of the middle brachot, any of the middle 13 requests, you're allowed. Me'ein ha-bracha, as long as it is on that topic. So you have someone specific you want to daven for in terms of health, you could do it in the middle, and you can add words. That doesn't have to be mental. You say, Yehi ratzon, to be God's will, that he sends a refuah shleima to my cousin, whose name is so-and-so, who's suffering from such-and-such. And if it comes to Barech Aleinu, which is the prayer for financial well-being, you say, may it be your will, God, that you help the following families whose husband just lost his job and whose wife just... Right? You're allowed to do that, right? You're allowed, in fact, you probably should do that. Ketzad, he gives an example. The Shulchan Aruch gives an example. Hayalo chole, if you know someone who's sick, mivakesh lev rachman, birkat rifa'enu. You should ask for their well-being in the bracha of rifa'enu. And before you say the after, Baruch, you could add your thing. English, Hebrew, Yiddish, French, Swahili, whatever language you want. Hayat sarich parnasa, if the person needs parnasa, right, help with their livelihood. Mivakesh shalev, birkat hashanim, in that bracha. So you have all the brachot. Someone's, do you feel that someone particularly needs help in whatever area? You find out which of the brachot in the Amidah fits best. And you add it. And let's say there's something that doesn't fit any of the categories. You still have a safety net. Shema Kolenu. Shema Kolenu is a catch-all. Right? It's a catch-all. You could ask for anything you want in Shema Kolenu. Right? So you have to, whatever it is that doesn't fit into any of the other 13, you can add Shema Kolenu. And so this is the attempt on the part of the rabbis to try to find the medium, a happy medium between a set text, which the rabbis thought was important, because without it, we would not, probably not daven at all. And even if we would, we would not hit the important points. So the rabbis gave us a list of what they think were the important points we're supposed to ask for. Notice none of them is who should win the soccer game on Sunday, right? I think that's also part of something important to realize, right? Who are the rabbis to tell us what's important to daven for? Well, I think there's some merit to them telling us what's important to daven for, because otherwise we may daven for things. So we say it's for health, it's for peace, it's for forgiveness, it's for spiritual improvement, right? So the rabbis give us a list of what's important to daven for, and they also gave us Shema Kolenu, which was, you know, a catch-all. We could add anything you want. So they're trying to balance between a set tefillah, which is the model of the Beit HaMikdash, highly choreographed and specific, and a more personal tefillah, more on the model of the Avot, to just daven from whatever was on their mind. And we have the opportunity to do both. And that relates back to what the Ralbag said, because the more you're familiar with something, the less time you put into really understanding it or personalizing it or developing a close relationship with it. And we have the same challenge with davening. But we the Shulchan Aruch did provide at least some guidelines as to how to contend with that. I found this idea of the Ralbag to be so fascinating and so interesting that he admits that the more familiarity you have with something, the less time you put into it. And that's something we should try to overcome. It's not, the Ralbag's not saying it's good, right? We should try to, it happens in human relationships too, right? When you meet someone new, you spend a lot of time trying to get to know them. When you know someone for a long time, and then they tell you something new about themselves, you're like, oh, I've known you for 20 years. I've never known that about you. Okay, well, that's maybe that's human nature. But also, the more you are with someone, the less time you take to actively try to get to know them. And the same thing with the visiting places that you've never... Forget synagogues, right? How much of the history of Houston do we know compared to the history of cities we visited in Europe? For a day, we know everything about them. And in here, it's
human nature.
Right, that's what the Ralbag is saying. It's human nature, which we have to try our best to fight against. Yeah. Okay. Have a great day, everybody. Yeah.